you think about the tribulation period, which in the book of Revelation we see beginning in Revelation chapter 6 and it ends in Revelation 18. The question that we have is, what about the people of God? Are there Christians? Are there believers during the tribulation period? What is going on with the people of God in the tribulation? And that's the question that Revelation 7 is going to answer for us tonight. At the end of any movie, what happens? Well, you say, well, I know what happens to me. I turn it off and I go and I do the next thing. But no, I'm talking about on the screen. What happens at the end of a movie? The end credits scroll across the screen. They start coming down and some mildly dramatic music plays softly in the background. And you're more inclined to buy that music as a soundtrack and listen to it later than you are to actually listen to it and read the credits one name at a time. But the music is actually trying to get your attention so that you'll sit there, in theory, and watch all these names go by on the screen. Why? I think the question we may have asked ourselves before is, why are there so many names? There are hundreds of names, it seems, on the end credits of people who did all sorts of things. But the real question, and I did a little research on this for this lesson, Bible study takes you a lot of places. The question really is not, why are there so many names, but why are there so few? In fact, I found there's this one man online named Jeremy Vanneman. Jeremy Vanneman has artistic abilities and has been directly involved in the artistic side of producing over 30 feature films in recent years, in the last 10 years. If I named them, you would know most of the names. Big time movies. He's been an artist, and not only that, he's actually led teams up to 25 artists strong, overseeing their artistry and involvement in the movie production as well. So, he's a major player. Of the 30 plus major films he's done art and supervised art for, in all the credits that rolled, do you know how many of those movies he actually appeared in the credits for? 3. And he lets you know one of those 3 misspelled his name. That doesn't matter to us. We watch the movie. That's all we care about. But if you are that person who is connected to the production and you're not big enough to be mentioned on the opening credits, you really want to be listed there because that's a badge of honor. And you'll watch those things and you'll wonder, where am I? Where am I? Where am I? And when we read about the tribulation in the book of Revelation, it's kind of like that. We read about all these big players, the main actors, Christ and the Father at the throne, and all the things that they are authorizing and doing to judge the world. Then we read about all these fascinating angels and angelic beings, all these wicked people that are saying and doing things, and then on top of the characters, we have so many amazing events that are happening, circumstances that are going on. But the question that we may have lurking in the back of our minds because of our connection is, what about the people of God? Are they there? Well, John, in Revelation chapter 7, gives us an intermission, a dramatic intermission, a parenthesis in the seal judgments to answer that question. It's not that he hasn't said anything about it, but he tells us a lot more about it in Revelation chapter 7. Following this intermission, John will resume the seal judgment. So he'll tell us about seal judgment number 7 in Revelation 8, and he'll introduce all that happens after that. But here, he tells us about the people of God. And he does it in 2 stages. The first half of Revelation 7 tells us about a subgroup of the people of God that John will describe as 144,000. And we will talk about that group of people. After he introduces them, he introduces us to a second group of people. And these are a countless multitude of believers that are not the same group as the 144,000. And by the time he's done talking about these two groups, we know a lot more things about a lot more believers during the tribulation period. And so our curiosity is salved, and we're able to go on reading about the judgments that God is sending to the world. But before we even look at Revelation 7, here's what we already know about the believers in the tribulation period. Right now, I'm sticking to the book of Revelation. I'm not going to take us to Peter and Thessalonians and other places. We're just sticking to the book of Revelation. Here's what we know about Revelation. If you look at this chart, you can see the chart we looked at last week. It shows us that between seals 6 and 7 is where Revelation 7 and this description of God's people appears. And here's what we know about God's people before Revelation 7. During the tribulation, to one of the seven churches, Jesus said in Revelation 3:10, he will remove believers, church believers, believers in the church. He will remove them from out of that great hour of testing that he is going to send on the whole world. He will remove. The seal judgments are judgments that occur not because Satan did anything, not because people did anything, but because Jesus breaks the seal. That's what allows that to happen. And those events occur. And he will remove us from that. So believers in the church today are removed, which does heighten the question, so what about believers in the tribulation? Who are they? Where do they come from? We also read in Revelation 6, 9 through 11, after the first four seal judgments occur, seal number 5 introduces us to a group of believers who were slaughtered because of their loyalty to Jesus. These are people that had knowledge of the Messiah, and after the tribulation began, during the events of the first four seals, first half of the tribulation approximately, they made a decision to join with the Lord, to depend on Him, and to believe on Him as God and Savior. And they were slaughtered because of that. And they asked for God to send revenge because of their unjust deaths. And what does God say in Revelation 6:11? He tells them to wait until more are added to their number like them. And then seal 6 is broken. Worldwide cataclysmic events of seismic and universal proportions occur. And that's when we're introduced to the 144,000. So what we know is that church age believers will be removed before this period begins. Others on the earth, some will believe in that early stage of the tribulation and be martyred for it. But there are more believers to come. Probably because of those believers' faith. So, Revelation 7, verses 1 through 8, teaches us that God will seal 144,000 Jewish believers. Revelation 6:17 ends with the people of the world saying, "The wrath of the Lamb has come." They witnessed what happened in seal number 6. They looked back at it and they acknowledged what they had experienced as being the wrath of the Lamb. And their conclusion is, who is going to survive? Well, I'll tell you who is going to survive. The 144,000. That's the answer to that question. God tells us, John sees here in this vision. Again, we know the world doesn't have four corners, right? even if the earth was flat, it wouldn't have four corners. I was looking at, talking to my son Josh this week, and he said, if you stand in one place from our 12th floor apartment and you look around, if the earth is flat, it still looks round. Because you're standing in the middle of the horizon, which looks more like a 360-degree circle than a square. So when John says the four corners of the earth, it's a manner of speaking that means four different places that cover the whole sphere of the earth as we know it. These four angels that he saw in this vision have been given authorization to use wind to disturb the earth, the sea, and the trees to cause destruction through gale force winds and so forth. And there was a fifth angel that was sent to the scene that gave instructions from God not to do those things until he got to do his job first. His job was to put a seal on 144,000 Jewish believers. What do we know about these believers? What do we know about this seal? Well, the seal was, it says, placed on their forehead. The best way to answer this, what is this seal, is not that angels come down and put a little tattoo or place a chip into all the believers that is programmed with heavenly code. Any more than the seal is the mark of the beast, it's going to be that from, I mean, we don't know. But from this perspective, what we can say is, in a way that may be spiritually acknowledged, angels place a seal on these people, and that is recognized by God. It's not a physical, visible thing. They're marked by God, by this angel, for a special purpose. What is the identity of this group? I think from the outset we should say this. These are not 144,000 of the most successful Jehovah's Witnesses. These are not some mysterious hidden group of Jewish people that are hiding out in the mountains somewhere that will someday emerge from the caves as the lost tribes of Israel. These are people out of the lineage of the nation of Israel that God seals. That's what they are. They are what it says they are. What does it say about them in this passage? It says these people in verse 3 are servants of God, which means they're going to have a purpose, a mission to serve God in a special and a particular way. That is why they are sealed. It also says they are from the tribes of the children of Israel in verse 4. We won't talk in depth about this passage, but you can look ahead to Revelation 14. Revelation 14, verses 1 to 5, gives us additional information about the 144,000. From this passage we see in Revelation 14, these will be people, perhaps just men, of high moral integrity, who will not capitulate to sexual immorality. They may even be virgins, unmarried. That's not a necessary thing. Some translations indicate that. They may just simply be morally chaste men, but Jewish and believers. Revelation 14, verse 4 says that they will follow Christ, the Lamb, wherever he leads, indicating persistent service to the Lord from beginning to end of the tribulation. And they will be known in verse 5 of Revelation 14 for speaking the truth. This is just what the book of Revelation says about these people. Well, we can tell from these things, as these are people, Jewish people, who believe and who serve God with a special purpose, of high moral integrity, of truthfulness, who persevere. They follow the Lamb from the beginning of the tribulation to the end. Which is why, when the Lamb comes down to Jerusalem, they're standing there to meet Him, having fulfilled their mission, preparing the way for His coming. That is the purpose of this group. These details indicate they will be servants, children of Israel, men of moral integrity. They will follow Christ relentlessly, speak the truth. But the question is, what is their purpose? They will persist in serving Christ. This does not mean they will not suffer. Think of it this way. How many of you have ever played around with a punching bag? What do you do to that punching bag? You punch it. You punch the lights out of it. You kick it. You do whatever you can. There will be many people dying, even dying for their faith in the tribulation. These 144,000 will be the punching bags. They will provoke the Antichrist. They will witness for Christ. They will prepare the way. They will be beaten down and knocked down, but they'll never die because they have a job to do. One man, John Phillips, the commentator, writes this: "No other age has produced a company like this, a veritable army of militant believers marching unscathed through every form of danger. It has been theirs to defy the dragon, to bait the beast, to give the lie to the false prophet. Their calling has been to preach the gospel from the housetops when even to name the name of Christ called for the most dreadful penalties. They've been surrounded, these latter-day Jobs, with impenetrable hedges, able to laugh, to scorn all the grand inquisitors of hell. They have walked the streets in broad daylight, careless of the teeth-gnashing rage of their would-be torturers and assassins, true witnesses of Jehovah in the most terrible era of the history of mankind. The devil knows about this coming band of conquerors and writhes already in an agony of anticipation. And this is their mission. They will suffer all things the world suffers, but they will not die. They will follow the Lamb without relenting. They will remain standing." And again, that is why in Revelation 14, when the Lamb comes down from heaven, from the throne room, they meet Him victorious at Jerusalem. Now, let's talk just a bit about the 12 tribes themselves. This is certainly an emphasis in this passage. Why is it significant that they are mentioned, not just the nation of Israel, but the 12 tribes of Israel, which is a reference to the nation of Israel? We should identify these 144,000 believers as ethnic descendants of Abraham, the nation of Israel. That's what this means. They've believed on Christ as Messiah. They are not the church. These are not people who are church-age believers who enter the tribulation. These are not people of other ethnicities. These are not Jehovah's Witnesses. These are not any such thing. They are Israelites, descended from Jacob and his sons. John lists them out from all the tribes of the children of Israel, not just from Israel in general, all the tribes. To emphasize this exclusive identity, John lists out the 12 tribes, just so you don't say, well, this is just a way of talking about Israel in general. No, all 12 tribes. Some wonder how will it be possible to know which Jewish believers descended from which of the tribes. Well, it doesn't really matter that throughout history, so many events and circumstances have obscured the family tree of so many Israelites so that they're not able to say with certainty, I came from Reuben or I came from Benjamin or whatever. That's not necessary. All that's necessary is that God knows where they came from. And He has a perfect, impeccable ancestry in His mind. Some wonder whether the number 144,000 or 12,000 per tribe will be the actual headcount of this census, of this group. There's no reason to think that it's not. These are very specific numbers. Perhaps it's 144 and 1,000. Maybe these are round numbers. That's possible. But whatever the count is, it's going to be extremely close to whatever these numbers, which are specific, are. What's interesting is as this count is given, it shows us the way it's written, the way that God treats the tribes of Israel. He treats them with equality. All groups get an equal number. He doesn't treat one and say, I'm going to have 30 of you. And then I'm going to have 10,000 of you. They all get equal treatment in this count. 12,000 from every tribe. Now, I gave a handout to you. It's listed in the online notes, and I printed it for the in-person audience, that shows you some interesting details about these 12 tribes in the Bible as a whole. There are altogether 21 times that the 12 tribes are mentioned in a list form. Sometimes only 10 tribes are mentioned. Sometimes 13 are mentioned. Most of the time, 12 are mentioned. And on that chart, you can see all of that laid out in detail. What you'll notice is that all the lists of the 12 tribes vary from each other. And so we're not bound to a particular list that always has to be exactly identical to the others. Some of these lists are ordered based upon birth order, the way that they came out, born to Jacob. Sometimes they're listed in the order in which blessings were given to them by Moses or by Joshua or by Jacob. And in those series and sequences of blessings, their order often is changed. Sometimes the order is based upon the way that they were arranged around the tabernacle. Sometimes they're listed in an order that tells you the sequence of how they were given their real estate property in Canaan and so on. So there are different ways that they are listed. Another way that these lists are different is the names that are included. The early lists include the 12 sons that were born to Jacob. But after the tabernacle and after they moved into the Canaan land, the tribe of Levi was not given any real estate property. And so they weren't listed on the lists that were given for property rights. Instead, they were removed and they were distributed to cities throughout the nation of Israel. So you say, how did you have 12 tribes? The way you still had 12 tribes from the land assessment breakdown was that Joseph, one of the tribes of Jacob, had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and those both counted as a tribe. And so Joseph turned into two tribes, Levi disappeared, you still had 12 tribes on the lists that are about land inheritance. You have that sometimes. Other times you have other names disappearing. There are times that Dan, including here in Revelation, is missing from the list. There are times that a few others, Issachar, Simeon, and Zebulun, are missing from the list. In particular, in John's list, here are the things that stand out. Perhaps the most prominent thing that stands out in this list, as well as a few others, is that Reuben is not named first. Reuben was the first son born to Jacob. But here, in this passage, John names Judah first as the first tribe in the list. Why do you think that is? This is maybe the one thing I can say with some strong certainty based upon what Revelation teaches. Because the Lamb comes from the tribe of Judah. And of course, that has already been mentioned. I'm sticking to what the biblical data is here in Revelation. It's already been mentioned that way in Revelation 5:5. That he is the Lamb of the tribe of Judah. And he is the central figure of this book and prophecy, Revelation 1:1. And so, giving prominence to the tribe of the Lamb makes a lot of sense in this list. Other things that are interesting here are that Dan is excluded. Some people say that Dan is excluded because Dan led other tribes into idolatry and was very, very wicked in that regard, more than any other tribes, and so he doesn't get an eternal lot in the nation of Israel. The problem with that interpretation is that one of the listings in Ezekiel that specifically lists out the land allotments in the millennial kingdom lists Dan in that list. And so Dan is not missing from end time lists when you look at Ezekiel. Levi is mentioned here. Also, Joseph is mentioned, and one of his sons. His other son he gets to replace with himself. And I don't know why exactly. So we look at some of these differences in this list. There may be a reason for these differences, but there's no way to say with authority, I know why Dan is missing. I know why Joseph is mentioned and not Ephraim. There's no way to say that with certainty, which gives us a good, important lesson in Bible study. We can suggest possibilities, but we cannot speak with dogmatism where the Bible is not clear. I don't know why Dan is missing. The Bible doesn't tell me. He just is. I can study as much as I want, maybe come up with a clear answer. If not, I have to step back and say, I don't know. And that's important when we study a book like Revelation so that we focus on the main point. What's fascinating about this list is that all 12 tribes are mentioned in this list in equal proportion, which indicates God's faithfulness and grace to his chosen people. When you study so many other lists of them, a lot of times what you find is this person is mentioned first, and this one is second, and this one is third, because of their behavior, their performance as a tribe, their performance as a person, and so on. Here, they're treated equally. That's God's grace. That's his faithfulness. The very fact that he is still doing things for, to, and through the 12 tribes of Israel, which date back to 2,000 plus years before Christ, and have been through so many things in history. Think of how many times people have tried to eradicate Israel. And here is God, not just continuing to work through Israel, but to still operate through their 12 original tribes, basically. God is faithful not just to the nation, but to the tribes themselves. And he continues to treat them equally with respect and grace. It's amazing. If you know what some of these men had done, what did Levi do? What did some of these other men do? Simeon with Levi did some very terrible things. Reuben committed some very immoral acts. And yet, here they are at the centerpiece of God's future plans for the nation of Israel. And their names are mentioned, making a difference in the world for Christ as judgment falls on the world around them. So these are the 12 tribes, the 144,000 that are sealed. We have to make sure when we study something like this that we are not dogmatic about details that are not developed or explained. Focus on what is clear. Now, the second half of Revelation 7 is next. We'll return to more things about these 144,000 in Revelation 14. By the way, there's nothing significant about that either. that they're mentioned in chapter 7 and then again in chapter 17 and the number of perfection and all these kind of things. 14 and 144,000. You'll find all kinds of crazy stuff out there. The chapter divisions of Revelation have nothing to do with anything. They were slapped on by some guy many years later just to organize the Bible. So, what about these other people that are mentioned? It says, after these things, I looked and behold a great multitude which no one could number. Here we see another group of people that are not the 144,000. And this group of people differs from the 144,000 in some significant ways. This is how we know they're a different group. First of all, their number. How many was in the 144,000 group? Ta-da! 144,000, right? How many are in this group? An uncountable number. John was not able to get a head count. There were so many. We see that in verse 9. We also see that the first group appeared where? Where is the 144,000 functioning? On earth. Where is this uncountable number doing their thing? In heaven. At the throne room of God. Verse 9. And verse 9 again, we see the first group consisted of Jewish people from the 12 tribes of Israel. What are the ethnic backgrounds of this second group? What does it say? They're from every people and tongue and nation and tribe and so on, every family. These are people from all the nations of the world, by the way, which may also include Israel. More Israelites will believe on Christ than just the 144,000. That is a select group of people chosen on God's grace to accomplish a special purpose. But that's not the cap on how many Israelites can be saved. People from all nations are in this group. Also, John did not describe the first group's actions yet. We previewed a few things in Revelation 14. But what we see here is John simply says, here is this group. Here's what they are. Here's who they are. Then, in the second group, he actually tells us what they're doing. They're joining the angelic crowd, the 24 elders, the four angelic creatures at the throne, praising and worshiping the Father and the Lamb. Also, John knew the identity of the first group, but he wasn't sure about the identity of the second. He looked at the first and he said, here's who they are and here's how many there were, and there were this many in every tribe, and here are the tribes I need to list for this particular instance. The next group, he saw these are a lot of people from a lot of places in the world. One of the 24 council members of heaven said, do you know who they are? And John said, you know who they are, because he didn't know who they are. He was trying to get more information. See, they told him information about the 144,000. They wanted to see if he knew anything about this group, and he didn't. So one of the elders told him. So what do we know about this group? Well, one of the elders told him this group came from out of the tribulation, verses 14 and 15. They came out of the great tribulation, which indicates these are not believers that any of us are leading to the Lord right now. We have a commission as the church to take the gospel to all the nations of the world. But whatever work we get done in that regard will remove from the earth before the tribulation begins. So where did these believers come from? Out of the great tribulation. This period of time of judgment that God is pouring on the world. They emerged from this period. It's an isolated period of time. These are people who experienced the events we've read about so far. We also note that John treats this group distinctly from the group of martyrs in Revelation chapter 6. This is a different group. The question is, how did this group get to heaven? How did they die? Well, they could have died any number of ways, but in Revelation chapter 6, John describes that initial group who wanted judgment as a group of people who had been slaughtered for their allegiance to Christ. That was the reason, martyrs. Here, he doesn't say why they died, just that they died, and when they died, they washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb, meaning these are redeemed people who had received the righteousness that Christ offered through his sacrifice. Perhaps they died a martyr's death. Perhaps they died like a lot of other people because of all the catastrophic things that are going on. They died. Out of the tribulation, they died. But they arrived at the throne of God and praised him. This, it seems, is more of that number that was mentioned in Revelation 6 when the martyrs were told, wait, there are more believers coming. Wait. And it looks like this is a part of that waiting, the group that is going to join them. This is a distinctly different group. This group joins the growing crowd of worshipers at God's throne. I like this picture, this image in my mind. As you read Revelation, of course, before the tribulation, you begin in Revelation chapter 1. John, from a believer's church standpoint, a man who spent time with Jesus and the 12 disciples, a man who spent the rest of his life pastoring and shepherding churches throughout Asia Minor, now finds himself as an elderly man in his probably 90s, banished to an island, working in the quartz mines, doing back-breaking work as an elderly man because of his testimony. And from what we can tell, he's surrounded by a bunch of other actual criminals. He's alone on this island as far as his faith is concerned, suffering for his faith. And by his lonesome, on this banished island, on the Lord's Day, he's worshiping in the Spirit. Sometimes when we worship the Lord alone in isolation, it doesn't feel as great and grand as a throne room he describes, right? We're just stuck in this world in our suffering and we're worshiping the Lord. And it's at that moment that Christ appeared to him in his exalted state. And after giving messages to the churches, he says, John, let's tune out this suffering that you're going through and come and see what's happening in heaven in the future. He sees the throne room of God. And if you can envision the throne room of God in the center of this circle, in the center, as it's unveiled for us in Revelation, we're introduced to the Father and the Son at the throne, and then right around the throne is these four angelic creatures, right in the midst of the throne. Then outside of that is this circle of 24 elders, angelic council. Outside of that is this crowd of angels. And the more that Revelation unfolds, oh, there's a group of believers martyred for their faith. Then before you know it, there's another crowd of believers that John can't count. If the throne room is a room, this room's population density is rising. As the tribulation goes along, more and more angels, more and more believers are coming in and visible here, praising God at his throne. So as you look down on earth and you see the chaos and the judgment that is occurring, there's something else that is occurring. People are being ushered into the throne room of God. And John gets to see that perspective. This crowd joins the growing crowd, and this group receives an assurance of eternal rest. You look at this passage and this heavenly scene of them serving, which is a word for priestly service. It's a word for worship. They're worshiping Him day and night without stop. But we also see here in this setting that that is not going to last forever. I think sometimes in our hymns that we sing, the songs that we sing, we get this idea that I'm going to die, I'm going to go to heaven, which this isn't talking about us anyway, but we're going to go up there and we're going to just worship Him forever and ever at the throne. But we're not. We are all eventually going to be ushered into a new world that He is going to make, and we're going to live lives on that world. Worshipful lives. But they're doing this at this time during the tribulation as the rest of the events unfold. They are in heaven continuing to serve and worship the Lord. But we're also given some other insights into what they have in store in the future. Verse 15. They will serve Him day and night in His temple. And He who sits on the throne will, future, dwell among them. Here's the idea. They, from earth and the tribulation, have come out and up to Him. But when that whole chaos down there is done and they return, He will come down to them. This up here is temporary, though impressive, but more impressive is in the new world that we're all headed to here in the book of Revelation. He'll return us where we belong, and He'll come down to be with us and dwell with us and with them. They are the focus. Of course, we'll be a part of that world. And other things are mentioned as well. Notice what it says. In that time when He will dwell with them, you get to look forward to that. They shall never hunger or thirst anymore. They will never be hungry or thirsty again. Do you think they suffered any of those things in the first seal judgments? Those things are described. Those are things that are going to go on. They'll be very real experiences for them. But that'll be done. The moment they go to the throne, those experiences are over. And in the future, they will never hunger or thirst again in the new world that they'll be given. If you look at Isaiah 49:10, a millennial kingdom promise, the same thing is said. John is essentially quoting from Isaiah 49:10 in this prophecy. Again, showing what's happening in Revelation is not something that God is throwing together all of a sudden in the future to solve a mess that happened on the earth. It looks like chaos on the ground, but from God's perspective, this is a plan He's been working out with promises that He's sticking to from centuries ago. You see the difference here between looking at the world in the tribulation and looking at the throne room during the tribulation? One is orderly, it makes sense, everything is under control. The other looks like a tornado. Sometimes in our life now, we are not in the tribulation. Thank God for that. But it still feels like a mess, right? If we can peek and see the throne room of God in our minds, we can rest, even ourselves. And we don't have it near as bad as what it will be then. They also will never experience extreme weather conditions again. They will never suffer from the heat of the sun. They will never suffer intense heat, which is a fascinating thing because as you study Revelation, what you find is sun heat, burning heat, scorching heat, and then eventually it climaxes with a lake of fire that burns and the fire will never be quenched. On the opposite side are God's people who are given an endless supply of living water. And heat will never be a source of suffering again. To those of you at Faith Baptist Church who love the air conditioning, let me tell you, you won't have to worry about your air conditioner working in the new world that God is going to give to us. There'll be no need for it. The climate will be perfect. High temps won't be a problem. These extreme weather conditions also are mentioned in Isaiah 49:10. They will never experience pain, regret, or sorrow ever again. In that future, this is not yet present in the throne room. This is in the world that God is going to make when he dwells with them. And that little statement, these words here at the end of Revelation 7, are simply a sneak peek, a preview of what is described at length in Revelation 20 to 22. I was talking to someone recently who was sharing with me some thoughts about how good stories work. Good stories drop little hints, little previews, little promises early in the plot. And good stories don't just do that. They deliver in a big way at the end of the story. They get your hopes up at the beginning, then they leave you wondering if that's ever going to happen, and then at the end, when it looks like it's all going to fall apart, lo and behold, what they promised at the beginning happens. And it was better than was foretold. That's exactly what is happening here. This is a very scary story. This is a very real story. This is a very tragic story. And so there are little bits and pieces of the future dropped along the way to get our hopes up as God's people that it's going to be good in the end. So we hang with the story and don't bail out when it gets really scary. He's previewing these things. Someone asked me last Wednesday, when do our tears get wiped away? Now, this is technically talking about these particular believers in the tribulation. But when we die and we meet the Lord, even now, we don't lose our memory. We don't blank out about the past. We don't lose our ability to sorrow. Those things, the memories, the sorrow, the tears, the remembrances that are painful, those things are removed at the end of the book of Revelation when we enter the new world and the final judgment is complete. What's happening here is they're worshiping the Lamb. Remember Revelation chapter 5? The martyrs, they were saying, when are you going to avenge what happened to us down there? In heaven, vivid on their minds was the suffering they endured. Our memory will go with us into God's presence. It will be rebooted and refreshed and renewed when we enter the new world. This is a preview, just in case we start wondering in the next few chapters. Then, the most beautiful part of this passage, I believe, this is me, you may disagree, is what it says at the end. For the Lamb, we've already noticed the Lamb is called a lion, right? What is that? That is an oxymoron. These are two opposites. The hunter and the hunted. The powerful and the weak. He is the lion of the tribe of Judah and he is the Lamb of God. But notice another opposite, a mixed metaphor. The Lamb will shepherd them. He knows what it's like to be in our shoes because he is the Lamb. He died for our sins. And yet he is going to flip that script and he is going to lead us as a loving, gentle shepherd who knows where he's going. Psalm 23 fits in beautifully here for us as believers. Psalm 23 introduces us to the Lord as shepherd, which is a theme that runs throughout Scripture. Jesus describes himself in this way throughout John's Gospel. Of course, John is writing Revelation, so it's not a surprise that this theme comes up again as he writes. But this idea of Psalm 23, if you are a sheep who is stupid and knows nothing, which is what sheep are, all you know to do is to go where the food is. That's all you do. You follow your belly. You follow your instinct. You follow the flock wherever they go, wherever they want to go. But the shepherd has to lead them to do things, to go places that they would never have thought to go. And to get them up to the mountain. To get them to that plateau where the grass is lush and the water is fresh and pristine, the air is crisp, where they want to live forever, safe from their enemies. The good shepherd knows. He has to lead them where they don't want to go. They have to go through dark shadows. They have to go through misty valleys. They have to go past the glaring eyes of the enemies that are ready to devour them. And those sheep may wonder what that shepherd is leading them into. Why do I have to go down this dark, winding path? Why do I have to follow you along these cliffs that are so steep? Why do I have to go through that barren wilderness when there's such a green pasture sitting right here? And all the other sheep are enjoying it. Friends, the book of Revelation is a valley of epic proportions. It's a valley where the blood runs deep. It's a horrible place. It's a tragic journey. But the Lamb will lead his sheep to higher ground. And you come out of the other side. What you read right here in Revelation 7 is simply this. The shepherd's dropping little hints to let us know it's going to get dark and it's going to get ugly, but keep following the shepherd as you read, because what he's saying right here is at the end of the road. These people have a lot to look forward to because their shepherd is the Lamb. He will lead them to these waters. Don't think of these waters necessarily as some mystical fountain that if you can just get this water into your mouth, you will have this special quality that will make you immortal. No, you're immortal because you have a glorified body and God gave you one. That's why you're immortal. It's not because you get to drink some certain water. The point of this here is that imagine being a sheep who's parched, who's wiped out, you're wounded, and you made it through a long journey. And you get to the top and you break out of the thicket. And there's the stream that your shepherd has been promising all along. It's there. It's actually there for once, for real. And you rush and you lunge ahead and you throw your head into that cool stream and you are refreshed. How many nights have you gone to bed? How many days have you lifted your head? How many afternoons have you pushed and gutted through wishing for refreshment? That refreshment will come in full force and you'll taste it with your lips and more when we get to that new world. So hang on. There is an end to the ride. What are some key takeaways we should get out of this passage? Well, from this passage, we see that God is faithful to Israel. He approached Abraham and told him to go out into the wilderness on a journey he didn't know where he was going. Revelation may feel the same way. The history of the nation of Israel kind of looks that way. Where are they going? He told Abraham in Genesis 12, 2-3, I will make of your seed a great nation. And I will bless them, and they will be a blessing to the nations of the world. And when you read about the 12 tribes, the 144,000, you see God sealing them so many millennia later, and they are blessing the world through the Son. We also see what we often forget, and that is that gospel outreach is going to thrive in the tribulation. Though many are being judged for their sins, many are being ushered to the throne room of God through martyrdom and death, because of the witness of the 144,000 and of others. There will be people from all nations of the world. There's this idea that Jesus Christ cannot return at the rapture until we've gotten the gospel to every nation of the world. I'm not sure that's true. We should have that as a goal, but in its full sense, the coming of the Lord is when he actually comes down to earth at the end of the tribulation and establishes his kingdom on earth for 1,000 years and then ushers in eternity. It could be that where the church leaves off, the 144,000 finish off what Christ set out to begin, getting the gospel to every corner of the world. While missions will thrive and reach its apex in the tribulation, and finally, the Lamb himself is the source of all eternal blessings. It's not 144,000. It's not a large multitude in heaven. It's not the angels. It's not the seal. It's not the promises of the new world that are the big deal of Revelation 7. What is the big deal of Revelation 7? You should know the answer by now. This is a revelation of Jesus Christ. He's the protagonist. He's the focus. He is God, Revelation 7, 10 through 12 and 15. God on the throne and the Lamb. Revelation 7, 9, the people that stand in the throne room stand before the Lamb. The Lamb, verse 10, is the one who brings salvation. He is the source of salvation. He, verse 12, is the one who deserves wholehearted praise and worship. His blood cleanses us from all of our unrighteousness. He, the Lamb, deserves ceaseless service, even in heaven. And He, the Lamb, our shepherd, preserves and cares for His people even in eternity. He will not stop shepherding us even then. That's assuring. A chapter like this reminds us that though we, like John in Revelation 1, must suffer many things, and though we, like John, may feel limited in our worship today, the Lamb has far better things in store for His people now as in the tribulation. And the truths that help believers in the tribulation persevere should help us persevere as well, because our end and destination and our Savior is the same Lamb of God. He will lead us to the fountain of living waters. And I don't know about you, the older I get, the slower I get when I try to raise my kids. But I might be like Peter, who outraced John to the empty tomb, when I get a foot race, you, to the fountain of living waters. That day, we all rush to that stream, to that pool, for the first time, to be the first of many times, we'll realize it would be worth it.